Here's, let me point something out, because, you know, a few things that have struck me as I listened to you talk about this. When you talked about beyond a reasonable doubt, almost always in these cases, almost always, there's some leap of faith at the end. You know, they're going to have their side, and they want the jury to take that leap in their favor. We have our side. We want to take a leap in our favor. And that is really what we're talking about with beyond reasonable doubt. But if you don't take every step, if you don't take 9.5 or 9.9 out of the 10 steps in your case, it's the leap is too far. You can't just go in and say they didn't prove it because they had the leap of faith. You need to get them there, if not all the way there, as close as they did.
So let me talk about a case that I just tried last week, okay? And you and I, as we always do, we talk about cases, we help each other, we share ideas, we brainstorm. This is a 65-year-old great-grandmother who's watching her 7-year-old granddaughter. And this woman has no prior record. She's raised 3 children, multiple grandchildren, and now 1 great-grandchild. By all accounts, was a Kool-Aid grandmother. Everybody loved going to great-grandma's house. I mean, she was, you know, the grandma that out of the Currier and Ives, you know, painting, or the, you know, the Little House on the Prairie. No criminal record, no allegation she's ever mistreated a kid. The 7-year-old calls her mother twice and her grandmother, her maternal grandmother, so this is the paternal great-grandmother, calls her mother and the maternal grandmother twice each. They're both at work and leaves voicemails. Horrifically sounding voicemails. They're hurting me. They're trying to saw my wrists off. They get her home, and the great-granddaughter claims that her great-grandmother taped her mouth, taped her wrists, taped her ankles, took out a pruning saw and sawed her wrists. And the child had marks. The 7-year-old had marks on her wrists. Now, the mother described the marks as looking like a rug burn. The grandmother, the maternal grandmother, described the marks as looking like a rash or like an allergic reaction. If you had a latex allergy and you had put one of those old school thick rubber bands around your wrists. But both agreed to the police the next day that it did not look like anyone had sawed her wrists. And by the way, the fact I just told you was important because they didn't go to the police until the next day. They were so worried that their daughter / granddaughter had been sawed and abused that they didn't go to the cops until the next day. And the mother said, I didn't go to the cops until the next day because I didn't think the injuries looked as serious as my daughter was trying to make them sound by her great-grandmother using a saw. So that's a case I have to defend, okay? The obvious question you have to answer is, why is the prosecutor bringing this case if they don't believe in it? Why did the police identify my client as a suspect if they didn't believe she was the person who hurt the child? We have the voicemails. There is corroboration. This child, before the parents got a hold of her, is saying, Grammy's trying to saw my wrists off. And what's more, there are injuries. There are marks on this kid's wrists. You cannot use beyond a reasonable doubt the presumption of innocence as a defense. That's not the theme in theory of defense. It could not be in that case. We had to give the jury a viable alternative. This idea that something happened at that house, but what we know didn't happen is a saw. So you had to say to the, why did the child know that there was a saw there? And we had photographs of the child playing in the backyard with her cousins, you know, using a saw and doing gardening with great grandma. We had explanations for, we called other people that were in the home, the my client's husband, who allegedly walked in to the crime as it happened, and having him say, no, absolutely nothing like that happened. And I got to ask him, and oh, by the way, are you lying to protect your wife? No. I asked him, sir, if you would have seen your wife with your great-granddaughter taped up and your wife sawing her wrist, what you would have done? His answer was, we wouldn't be in court because we wouldn't have needed a jury. You know, so, you know.
And he meant it.
Yeah, of course he did. He's right. And in fact.
He's the kind of guy that you know means it. Right.
And in fact, he punctuated that by saying, I'm old school. We wouldn't be in court. There wouldn't need to be a jury. So again, you have to give them something to hang on to. It can't just be this idea that, and again, we understand the difficulty of proving a negative. We understand this idea of you're a witch, prove you're not. Look how that happened in Salem, right? You know, like, well, you know, if you, unless you confess, we're going to hang you. So you either have to confess or prove you're not a witch, right? Well, right. And so the ones that couldn't prove that they weren't a witch got hung, and the ones that confessed were
burned. Right.
So, you know,
right.
Like,
now you're burned at the stake because you're a witch, right?
So, you know, like it's this idea that you know, it's so difficult to prove a negative, which is why these presumption of innocence and the burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt exist to begin with. But I think that is a really good, that's not a shaken baby or abusive head trauma case, but it's a child abuse case that I use to illustrate this idea that you can't just say they didn't prove it. It has to be something more than that, because why would the 7-year-old make up this story? Why were the marks on her wrists? Why did she talk about a saw that the police actually found? You know, why the voicemails before the child had a motive to lie? You know, you have to give them answers to that. So when we go back to this abusive head trauma, shaken baby syndrome idea, you have to have an alternative explanation.
And going back to another thing you said, I'm going to create this paradox, and I think it'll help us shift into the next phase of what I want to talk about. But you mentioned doctors, and you almost said it in jest, like, who's going to tell a doctor that he's wrong or that she's wrong? Because we all know that these doctors have these giant egos. They've made movies out of this kind of stuff. Like, damn it, don't tell me I'm wrong. I know I'm right. And you can almost see the scene in the movie when all the team is...
Wasn't the Richard Gere character in the Nicole Kidman movie? I'm bored. When you ask, no, it's not Richard Gere. It was
Baldwin. Alec Baldwin.
It was Baldwin. When you pray to God, I am God.
Right. It was like this caricature of what we're talking about.
100% it is. It's such effective movie making because we've all dealt with a doctor like that.
Right. Even though it was an exaggerated version, but we all know what that means.
Yes.
And the other problem, which I think is less obvious, is on our side. Because what you're describing is I can defend this case. I don't need an expert because I know what happened, and I can do it without what we're about to talk about, because damn it, I'm a criminal defense lawyer. I've been doing it for 30 years. I've tried how many cases, and I've got it. I know what I'm doing. These cases are different, and maybe they're not that much. Maybe they're only different in degree than a normal criminal case. Because if I go into a normal criminal case, maybe you can wing it and get away with it a certain percentage of the time or not get exposed. But in these cases, you can't. And I think the same ego on the doctor's side exists on the lawyer's side, where lawyers with big egos, like we all have, don't have the ability to set aside their ego like you just did, frankly. You know more medical science than anybody I've ever talked to in the legal profession on these types of cases, and you still say you need experts.
I can't win a battle with a child abuse pediatrician on the witness stand in front of a jury.
And you can't pick what happened to that kid without corroboration. And you may have some ideas when you go into it. You may have some thoughts. But every case on these I've worked with you, it starts with, hey, doc, here's the thing. Here's the radiology. Here's the scan. Here are the medical records. By the way, going all the way to birth, help us figure out what happened. We're not going to tell you what happened. You're going to tell us, and then we're going to work it.
I can't imagine there's anything left in life that can't be compared back to a Seinfeld episode, right?
Right.
Remember the Seinfeld episode where he's talking where George is talking to Jerry about getting his car fixed with putty, and he goes, oh, well, you got a bad Johnson rod. Oh, no, not the Johnson rod. You know, this is going to cost you a fortune. They make shit up, right? Well, that's exactly what a child abuse pediatrician could do. Well, you know. We know that this was abusive head trauma because the Johnson bone was fractured. Johnson bone, you know what I mean? Like, quite literally, they are more trained, more educated, and have more experience on these issues You and I didn't go through medical school. We didn't go through residency. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. You can't fight them and win without the assistance of somebody who also went through that.
And not just the other mistake we've seen. Well, look, let's talk about the case that we're working on. It's on appeal. So these are winnable on appeal that we've talked about. And somebody fell into a trap of picking a theory to try to explain the medicine and then cramming the science into it without getting an array of experts to try to figure it out the way you're talking about. I think it's an obvious answer, but talk to us about that scenario and how an otherwise experienced lawyer can fall into that trap in these types of cases.
Well, let's even take it up one half step further back, because I think you've really uncovered an interesting dilemma or contrast is the word I was looking for. You've talked about two cases you and I have been brought in to consult with and work on. One in Arkansas, one in another state that we won't mention for various reasons. The case in Arkansas, these lawyers, if they had a problem with experts, they had too many. I mean, right? They had multiple radiologists. They had multiple forensic pathologists. They were so well experted, with an army of experts. I mean, our job was to sort of help them weed through what they should use from what the experts were telling them, what they shouldn't. I mean, they were so well prepared and so well researched. It was phenomenal. They did such a great job defending that case and experting that case. The other case was the exact opposite, right? The other case was, I'm going to talk to my buddy who's a retired pathologist. He's going to come up with a theory, which in this case was meningitis, which is easily refuted by just looking at the slides from the blood work at the autopsy, and that's going to be enough. And what happened in the two cases? The cases where they had all the experts, he was found not guilty. He was acquitted. The case where they didn't have the proper expert or experts, that woman was convicted.
And by the way, factually very similar cases.
Very similar cases.
Yeah, very similar cases.
Very similar cases. In fact, there is a brilliant passage in the Court of Appeals opinion we got in this other case by a Court of Appeals judge in this state that said something to the effect of, unless I am to believe that this woman with no prior criminal record running a daycare that had 12 security cameras on it decided to abuse a kid for the first time without any eyewitnesses, then the...
After 15 years or whatever.
Of running a daycare, then something is, something is rotten in Denmark here, yeah,
Something doesn't add up.
Yeah, right.
And yet it happened. Yet this woman got charged and convicted.
Of second degree murder.
Yeah, life in prison.
Right.
And
because it was felony murder, because it was a child abuse with the murder, right?
And if not actual life, then effective life because of her age. And it's remarkable how thin the tightrope really is if it goes the wrong way. I mean, there is no middle ground here.
So let's sort of start with building a defense, okay? So before we get to the common issues, I think we sort of start with, What do we do here to prepare before we even start asking some of these questions? So this is the first steps I do when I get hired on a case like
this. So this is like in the brain of Mark Satawa, and it's interestingly, it's sort of like a scientific formula. For a reason, because by doing, let me just point this out, whether you realize it or not, what you're doing is you are unburdening yourself or putting steps in place to unburden yourself of your own ego and bias on what you think happened. And that's what this kind of formulaic approach does.
So we are nothing without information. We have to know more about the case than the prosecutor does. They have the police, they have subpoena power, they have the ability to arrest people, they have the ability to send police officers out anywhere to interview people.
And money, lots of money.
Lots of resources, lots of money. They have a child abuse community supporting them, a child abuse pediatrician with all the doctors working at that hospital that will never take the child abuse pediatrician on. Don't believe me? Google the doctor in Minnesota who sued the Children's Hospital in Minnesota because she refused to go along with the child abuse pediatrician. She took on the child abuse pediatrician complex, as I keep referring to it, like the military industrial complex. She took on the child abuse pediatrician complex, and she got fired. And she's now suing as a kind of a whistleblower to say, like, look, if you don't say what the child abuse pediatrician, as a radiologist, as a neurologist, as a neurosurgeon, as a ophthalmologist, as a whatever, as a orthopedic, if you don't say what that child abuse pediatrician wants you to say, there will be consequences. She got fired.
They'll run you out. Look, and there's lots of examples in this in all sorts of areas of medicine. I mean, COVID being not the least of which, right? Anybody who challenged the conventional or what the mainstay was, guys 6 months before who were recognized as the top in their field, well, now they're cast out. And same in this field.
So information is incredibly important. So the first thing I have a client do, and when you say timeline, I think most people think of like a bar graph with 10 entries on it. I mean, I'm not satisfied until these timelines are 50 Microsoft Word pages long, at least. You tell your client, and if their partner is supportive, and interestingly, most of the time they are. Most of the time, the person who knows you the best does not believe you're capable of doing this. And so I have typically represented the husband, the father, whatever, the boyfriend, and the wife, the lifetime partner, the girlfriend, whatever, has been supportive. And interestingly enough, because women are just so much better at most things, including this, the timeline and a lot of the work comes from that wife, that mother, that girlfriend. Start with the day you found out the mother was pregnant, and you need to chronicle everything. No event is not important enough. She slipped down and fell on the stairs. She got preeclampsia. She was a high-risk pregnancy. She was induced. It was a vaginal delivery. It was a C-section. And you go through every day from the day you found out the child was pregnant, the mother was pregnant, until the day the child was diagnosed with abusive head trauma. Everything. And again, these are hundreds of entries. There's so much information that should be in those. And I'm not satisfied until it is that detailed and that complex. Okay? So that's step one. Step two is to gain the medical, and I never trust that the medical records I get from the prosecutor in discovery are complete, because they're not. And I'm not saying prosecutors are doing anything wrong. They're getting sent what the police get them, but the police aren't doing, they're not getting everything that I need. I mean, they get a child abuse pediatrician's report, and then they get radiology reports. So I want all the medical records. I mean, everything. I want the OBGYN records of the mother during the entire pregnancy. I want the labor and delivery records. I never get them from the prosecutor. I want the pediatrician of the child for the first month, two, six, whatever, of the child's life. You rarely, if ever, get those. I want any hospitalizations. So like these cases where we talk about where there's multiple hospitalizations, I just don't want the hospitalization where the abusive head trauma was diagnosed. I want those previous hospitalizations. And most importantly, the one thing you never get unless you go out and get it is the actual radiology. I don't want the radiologist telling me I see a subdural hematoma, mixed density, bilateral, left bigger than right, whatever. I want the actual CT. I want the MRIs. I want the x-rays. I want the bone scans. There's a really important reason for that. Again, we talked about how subjective radiology is, but you have to get the actual film on electronic, first generation electronic copy, typically sent to us on a jump drive or CDs. You have to have that. You have to have the actual radiology. So you need the timeline from your client. You need complete medical records, including the actual radiology. And then you're going to get the discovery, which are the police reports, the witness interviews, the medical records that they wanted you to get, or at least the medical records that the police got and gave to the prosecutor. And you're going to have the clients engage in yet another round of and look, doing this requires clients that are dedicated to proving their own innocence. And most clients,
this is a team effort.
Mm-hmm. Most clients are motivated to do that. Every once in a while, you got to give a little gentle nudge because, look, I hired a really good lawyer. I paid you a lot of money. Why aren't you doing this? Well, because I didn't live this. You did. You know the information. I don't. And you have them review that. And they footnote or annotate that discovery. I mean, if you're not getting 100, 200 footnotes in 100 pages of discovery, then your clients aren't doing the job. And I want that. I want red used to mark up the discovery so that when I'm in a courtroom, I'm not looking for black or blue number 8. I'm looking for a red that's going to stand out on a black and white piece of paper. And I want the footnotes sent to me in Microsoft Word format so I can cut and paste them into my preparation. And then finally, I want a narrative similar to a timeline, but it's kind of their story of what happened, tying everything together. Okay, so, you know, we were so excited when we found out Julie was pregnant. You know, it was a high risk pregnancy. She was put on bed rest. The day, you know, little blank was born was the happiest day, et cetera. Okay. After you have all that information, now you start looking for experts. The first step in vetting experts, and we're going to come back to experts later because we're going to sort of get back into the general preparation of when you get one of these cases. But before you really start looking for experts, step one is to get the radiology to a radiologist, really a neuroradiologist, ideally a pediatric neuroradiologist who's going to look at them. And because radiology is so subjective, they're going to tell you, okay, look, they say this is a mixed density subdural. They're right. Take a look at this here. There is evidence that this injury is weeks old, if not months old, whatever it is, right? I've had the radiologists I've used find undiagnosed aneurysms. I've had, radiologists I've used find additional, like, evidence of other things going on in the head that the radiologist from the hospital didn't even talk about. So step one, and I include the radiology outside the vetting of experts because that really is step one to deciding which experts you need. That's sort of part of that initial screening. Timeline, narrative, annotating discovery, medical records, actual electronic copies of the radiology, and then sending them to a radiologist to be reviewed is all step one, believe it or not. That's all step one.
And what from there?
So again, now we have to start breaking our case down into what case is this? So when defending these cases, there are two ways. We referenced this a little bit ago. First thing we can always talk about is was a crime committed? Is the reason for the child's collapse abuse? And then the second thing is there any proof of a specific perpetrator to commit that abuse? So these are two complementary, related, but separate questions. you don't ever, as you know, as a criminal defense lawyer, you don't ever take on more than you can chew. I don't need to disprove abusive head trauma unless that's the only defense available. And it almost always isn't. So a common issue we talked about a minute ago is timing is getting harder and harder for child abuse pediatricians to and prosecutors to prove. The idea that children don't have a lucid interval after the trauma, if it is trauma that caused these injuries, is just being debunked more and more every day. There is so much evidence, scientific, medical evidence out there that lucid intervals can and in fact do exist. If your child ever got a concussion playing hockey or soccer, they tell you to wake your child up every hour to make sure that they're not neurologically distressed. Why? Because they could be having a lucid interval. They could be fine, go to bed and wake up dead. There's more and more scientific and medical journals, studies, criticism of the idea that lucid intervals don't exist. It's again becoming central to the diagnosis of abusive head trauma and central to the identification of a specific person or perpetrator of that abusive head trauma is this timing that's becoming more and more difficult to prove. There are any number of potential alternative causes that we can talk about here for a minute. So again, are we attacking the diagnosis of abusive head trauma that a crime was committed? Are we attacking the timing or the identity of the perpetrator that wasn't our client? Sometimes you can go after both, but you don't have to. Sometimes you go after only one or the other. But again, it's getting more and more difficult to avoid this timing issue because there's just so much out there. So many different ways to attack the timing prosecutors and child abuse pediatricians advance. That second issue is almost always present in every case I do and that we consult on. The first issue is sometimes an issue, sometimes not. Next step. Okay, we've sent the radiology to the radiologist. Our client has provided us the timeline, the narrative, the footnoting and discovery, and we have all the medical records. Now we have all the information, at least, and obviously it's a moving target. We have a lot of information, so now we have to come up with, all right, what is our explanation? What happened? All right, and again.
And you can't do that without first getting all this other stuff. And I think this, not to cut you off, but this is where lawyers go wrong with these cases. And like I said, we have to unburden ourselves of our egotistical theories of what we know happened already. And you do all this stuff, and then typically what happens in these kind of cases, or any case I work on, when you do this stuff, what happened, our theory, tends to emerge from that. In other words, that work informs this question and not the opposite. And this is where people go wrong.
This is, if doing these cases for the last 10 plus years have taught me anything, it's that there is no one-size-fits-all approach to defending any one of these cases any more than there's a one-size-fit-all expert for every one of these cases. So, I mean, you and I talk all the time. You understand how often I get contacted for help. And I try to be free in not like monetarily free. I mean, I try to be giving.
Yeah, you help people call you and say, Mark, I'm working on a case. What do I do?
Yeah, and I try to be giving of my time and my expertise in that situation. But the one thing I can't help is those that don't want really help. And this is sort of an example for our friends out there of the sausage getting made. We haven't rehearsed this. But take a guess as to the most common question I get about experts. Like, what is the first question everyone calls me and says, hey, Mark, I got one of these cases.
Can you refer me to the best expert?
See, and it's amazing that we didn't have to rehearse that, you know, because that's the question I get asked. And I said, well, what do you mean? Well, I need the best shaken baby or abusive head trauma expert. I go, okay, well, tell me about your case. Well, what do you mean? I just need an expert. Okay. Is it a mechanism case? Do we have an alternative mechanism? Did the child, is it possibly a short distance fall? Did the child get recently vaccinated? Is it possibly a chronic subdural that rebled? Was there an aneurysm that caused these injuries? I mean, you know, is there an alternative mechanism? Is it a lucid interval case? Can the prosecutor not prove that your client was the one that committed the abuse? Is it an alternative suspect? Like I had the child for the hour before we went to the ER, but I didn't abuse the case. I don't know what happened before, you know. So again, like, the idea that there is some like magic abusive head trauma shaken baby syndrome expert out there is the kind of thinking that got that woman convicted in the daycare case that you and I talked about a few minutes ago. It just doesn't happen. Every case is different. Every case has a different type of expert. Again, is it a lucid interval case? Is it a rebleed of a chronic injury? Is it a case with an alternative possible cause, like an aneurysm or vaccination? Is the issue timing? Can you point the finger at another expert, a suspect? Is the issue the mechanics of this injury, or is it some combination? Once we know those answers, we can start unpacking how we go about identifying the right expert. Again, there is no one specialty area anymore for experts in this field. That's 20 years ago thinking. It just isn't that way anymore. Again, so what is our alternative explanation? What do we say happened? Do we say the child did have trauma? If so, do we have a different alternative explanation? Short distance fall be the most common. Is it a timing issue? Is it a lucid interval issue? Again, answering those questions coupled with that five or six things that we gathered, the discovery, the annotations, the narrative, the timeline, you know, what the radiologist has told us, now we can start talking about what kind of expert we need. It is important to note something here. Impact always changes things, okay? What we're talking about for the most part during this podcast is the idea of abusive head trauma, shaken baby syndrome with no evidence of impact. And by impact, I mean skull fracture, abrasions to the head, an obvious impact to the head. If there's impact to the head, a lot of this stuff goes out the window. Most doctors, not all, I mean, and again, there might be an alternative explanation. Maybe it was a short distance fall, for example. But to the extent we're talking about the science and medicine behind abusive head trauma, most of the things that help us defend these cases do go out the window when there's evidence of injury to the skull or to the scalp.
Unless there's an alternative explanation.
And again, that becomes an alternative explanation case.
Right.
That is what the explanation must be. Like, how did this happen? Did the child fall out of his crib? In your case, did the child fall out of his, you know, like, again, I mean, that has to become the...
Well, look, let me, we could go on and on here, but I we're going to have to wrap it up soon. But before we do that, I wanted to ask you, you've mentioned already that people call you, and by people, I mean lawyers. Are you limited only to Michigan? And how does, if I call you and say, Mark, I've got this case, what can you offer me? And I'm not just asking I don't believe in dumb questions, because at least somebody's calling and asking you the question, yeah, what expert I need, because then they're going to get the right answer. It might not be the answer they thought they were going to get, but they're going to get the right answer. But short of that, do you consult? Do you go around the, like, where do you take this expertise?
So, The short answer is no, I'm not limited to Michigan. And the longer answer is I've done cases, as you've mentioned, all over the country, including Arkansas, Illinois, Missouri, Ohio, Michigan, New York, Virginia, Georgia. So, I mean, Hawaii. So, no, I mean, I consult with cases whenever people need me to help. You and I own a consulting company, and we have consulted in multiple abusive head trauma, shaken baby cases in other states. We've done mock trials. We've done focus groups. We've done week-long brainstorming sessions with these lawyers. No one we've worked with has ever told us that we didn't provide significant insight and help to them. I like to think that as good as I am as a trial lawyer and as doing these cases on my own, I think I do every bit as good a job as a consultant doing that kind of consulting role. I think that these cases, you know, we and if I can just go off on a couple of tangents, I know we're running out of time, but I'll try to be brief. Couple of things, okay? After we've done all the steps we've talked about, now we can start talking about, okay, what possible experts, and we've consulted on cases where we've suggested to other people, you know, what kind of expert do you need? Obviously, if the baby's dead, you need a forensic pathologist, okay? You got to start with a radiologist and a forensic pathologist. If the baby's still alive, what do you need? For a general shaken baby case, very effective experts tend to be ER docs because they see these children as soon as they come in. They have a lot of experience in seeing different forms of injury causation, different forms of trauma. And if you have one that is willing to sort of be open-minded, eyes open, looking at this objectively, they can be excellent experts. I love ER docs as potential experts. But again, you have to remember, for the ER doc, for any medical doctor, it is a huge mistake to fall into the trap to use them to opine on injury causation, because you're going to go into the same problem that the child abuse pediatrician and the prosecutor's expert is going to try to do. You need the child's pediatrician. You have to talk to the doc who's been treating this child for the first week, month, year of the child's life. A pediatrician, by the way, presumptively, who is a mandatory reporter and has presumptively not filed a referral to Child Protective Services.
The one person that would notice any injuries to the kid is the doc that sees the kid at regular intervals.
All the well checkups, right?
Yep.
You might need an orthopedic on these cases where corner metaphyseal lesions or long bone injuries are there or suddenly heal. You're going to need to talk to an orthopedic, a neurologist or a neurosurgeon. And again, you may want your own child abuse pediatrician, and you may want, I'm sorry, you're going to want the child's treating pediatrician, and then you may want your own child abuse pediatrician. There are a growing number of child abuse pediatricians that are starting to be a little troubled by the idea that we are convicting people of this crime of child abuse at a rate that exceeds, by significant factors, any other Western country, to the point where Sweden conducted a multidisciplinary study on these cases. And the Swedish government prosecuting these cases said, hey, look, we want a panel of experts similar to the National Academy of Sciences in the United States. We want you to take a deep dive into these cases. Tell us if there's any reliable support for the idea of abusive head trauma as diagnosed by a subdural hematoma, retinal hemorrhaging, and neurologic distress. They found none.
Isn't that remarkable?
Remarkable.
In a case, in a situation where they weren't looking at an actual case where there's actual emotion or there's actual people biting at it, they find no correlation.
No scientific, no reliable scientific data, experimentation data support to prove the basis of the diagnosis. So that leaves the final expert that you should consider. And this is always important when the issue is an alternative explanation or alternative injury mechanism, and that's a biomechanical engineer. And the beauty of them is if the case is well-financed enough, if the case has the resources behind it that these cases really need, unfortunately, And that is they can rent these anatomically correct dolls. I think they have them at 3 months old, 6 months old, 9 months old, 12 months old, and they can do experiments. I mean, I had a case where the issue was, did the child fall off a sofa? And he did. He put these sensors on it and he did the experimentation. He shook the child as hard as he could and measured the force he created. And let's say it was at 5,000. And then he shook the child and then slammed the child on an ottoman. And that increased. Now, I think the first one was 2,500, then increased it to 5,000. And then he did he stood the anatomically correct doll, like a kid, like basically whose head was at the level of a couch, and just let it fall off the couch. And that 10,000 doubled. So again, you can show these experiments. You can show this videotape to the jury if your case is a short distance fall case, you're going to want to buy a mechanical engineer. So again, identify the right expert that fits the facts of your case. And then finally, you need to really seriously consider. And I can tell you that every one of the cases I've done this where I was the lawyer, and every time I've been hired as a consultant, these cases beg for the use of a focus group and or a mock trial. There are so many different moving parts. In fact, the case you keep talking about in Arkansas, I know these lawyers, to their credit, I mean, they were everything that you were saying to avoid. They were open-minded. They listened. Well, not only were they great lawyers, but they were great lawyers that didn't let the greatness.
That's what made them excellent.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They didn't let their greatness get in the way. I mean, they listened. And when we went down there and did the brainstorming with them, we came up with this idea like, you know, we really need two focus groups here. The first day, we're going to need to do just the science, just the medicine. We're not going to talk about any of the facts other than the stuff the doctors are going to say. And then we're going to bring the focus group back, and then we're going to talk about all the normal facts that are present in every criminal defense case. Like, so in that case, it was this idea of the prior incident at the daycare, and then the prior incident falling out of the high chair, I think it was, and then the other evidence that had to do with the 911 call and some of the weirdness that you could hear. I think the older sister is in the background of the 911 call. Some of the problems that were going on between the defendant and his wife or the mother of the child, and some of that, you know, dynamic. These cases, there's so much nuance. There's so many different, it's like an onion, right? Every time you peel off a layer, there's another layer. You peel that layer back, there's another layer. You peel that layer back, oh my God, that layer split. It's two layers, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much nuance. There's so much complexity that these cases almost beg to have a focus group done. They almost beg to have that focus group followed up with a mock trial. And again, look, whether it's us or someone else doing it, you don't have to take all the consultation advice you're given. It's another tool in your toolbox. It's another quiver it's another arrow in your quiver. You know, this idea that you take what works for you. You take what helps you win your case. There's parts of it you don't. And you and I both agree. You ignore what focus groups or mock juries tell you at your own peril. But you don't have to take it all. But it the process of getting ready for a focus group, the process of getting ready for a mock trial, the brainstorming and preparation that goes into it, and then the actual execution of it and the feedback you get from either the focus group or the mock jury,
lawyers will never be more prepared than they are at that moment to go try their case. I mean, it's just a fact.
It's incredible. It's incredible how much this helps. And again, I mean, like, you gotta read, you gotta learn, you gotta know about Nevis out of New Jersey, where the New Jersey Supreme Court, the highest court in the state of New Jersey, said, you know, there's no scientific validity behind shaken baby. And under Daubert ruled that it wasn't reliable enough to come in a criminal prosecution against someone. Trial courts all over the country, drips and drabs, these rulings are coming out. There's one out of Illinois. There's one out of Kentucky. There was a bench trial done by a brilliant lawyer in Kentucky. This, you know, if you are defending one of these cases, you got to get a copy of that opinion. You got to read it because that judge got it. That judge really understood what was going on. Really, really understood. Like, look, these child abuse pediatricians and the state's experts they're talking loud, but they're saying nothing. There's no substance at all behind what they're saying. You got to file your Daubert motions. You got, like any other case, right? You got to make the prosecutor. You got to make sure you focus in the issues so that you're not trying to defend against, you know, the Hannibal's hordes. You're picking off the auxiliary troops and you're focusing your defense on the main force, the main accusation against your client. So you got to file your Daubert motions. If you have a probable cause stage of a hearing in your jurisdiction, like we do in Michigan and like you don't in Ohio, you have to hold that hearing. And you have to be as prepared for that hearing as you would be for trial. And you have to cross-examine that child abuse pediatrician. And then you have to make an argument. Judge, they haven't convinced anyone that a crime occurred. There's no validity behind that diagnosis. And even if they have, where's the timing? Where's the proof that my client committed that crime? And if you don't win there, you got to file a motion to dismiss the indictment or the information in the trial court level because that was an abuse of discretion to continue the case. You got to get ready to cross-examine the state's experts. And you can't do that without your own experts. And again, you know, you go back to, you take all of this, it's going to be a mess of stuff. How do you make sense of it? Well, you either got to do it on your own or you got to use a focus group or a mock trial to help you to wade through it. I mean, that's the recipe for success. Now, you know, we haven't even really talked that much about post-conviction and appeals, and we can certainly do that, but in the end of the day, that trial the trial court preparation comes down to that.
Well, look, you win these cases at trial. And sometimes we've had, and I don't want to go into a deep dive on post-conviction because I do want to wrap this up. But we, you know, if the best time to hire somebody like you is now, is as soon as you're accused or you feel like you're getting accused, the best time to hire somebody like you or somebody who will consult with somebody like you is now. Get a good lawyer. If it's too late and it's post-conviction, we're coming in now. We're working on a few of those already. But the best time is now.
Well, just in 2 minutes or less on this post-conviction stuff, look, they can be won. And there's a common thread on the issues, right? They commonly focus on ineffective assistance of counsel because the lawyer didn't consult with an expert
or
they consulted with an expert, but not the right expert. There was actually a case in Michigan, People v. Ackley, where that lawyer consulted with an expert that was a prosecutor's expert, like somebody who, like
a believer
in right. in the diagnosis, and he's like, look, you don't want me. I'm a believer. You need to call someone else. That lawyer never called anyone else. The Michigan Supreme Court reversed that conviction, unanimous opinion, by the way, citing not just the debate and controversy about abusive head trauma or shaken baby syndrome, but saying, this is like they compared it to a religion. This is like trying to mediate between, you know, differing religions who claim that only they worship the one true God, right? So they compared it to that level of bombastic, you know, vitriol and emotion. And so they said, hiring an expert and consulting with an expert isn't enough. You got to hire the right expert and consult with the right expert. You know, but again, other issues are failure to secure full discovery. How many times have you and I seen that? Not even getting basic discovery. The lawyers that don't have all the medical records, they never got the radiology that we're talking about. Didn't even ask to get it. Yeah. You know, and so that's a problem. And finally, one other final issue on appeal that has proven to be very successful, it's got some viability to it, is these cases tend to have a high incidence of prosecutorial misconduct. One of the appeals I won in Michigan several years ago was a prosecutorial misconduct where the alleged misconduct was so bad. You know, you know what it's like.
Yeah.
Courts of appeals, they never out people by name. They'll say the prosecutor, right? Or the defense attorney. It was so bad that the prosecutor was named by name, and what he did was quoted directly by the Court of Appeals from the transcript, talking, you know, it was this outrageous community, you know, putting the jurors in, you know, like, you know, scare tactic.
Yeah, everything you can possibly imagine. Like, you know,
So there are common threads even in the appeals, right? Ineffective assistance of counsel, failure to secure experts or even the right expert, not getting enough experts or the wrong experts, failure to get discovery, failure to get the medical records, prosecutorial misconduct. That's sort of, you know, like a very, very quick brief summary on some of the effective approaches we've used and I've used and you've used on these appeal cases and post-conviction matters. Look, it's like George Clooney said in Billy Clayton, right?
Where he was
I'm a janitor.
Right, he was the fixer, yeah.
The earlier you hire me, the smaller the mess, the easier it is for me to clean up. And that's really the point you're making. Like, if you wait until after you're convicted, the mess is a lot bigger than hiring somebody competent that's an expert or a specialist at the onset of the case at the very beginning, because the mess is smaller. It's it's an easier case at that point. Once you're convicted, once the law puts that little bit of finality, that stamp on the case that you've had your day in court, you've had a jury say you're guilty, and now, you know, the
law. It's tough to unring that bell.
The law favors closure, and we want everyone to be able to move on.
Well, the point we're making, and the reason I wanted to talk to you about this is there's people out there sitting there right now, maybe facing an accusation of abusive head trauma, or facing an accusation of some sort of child abuse, and they've talked to their local lawyer, they talked to another lawyer, or in that process of picking of choosing who to hire, maybe they've already hired somebody. This is a great guidepost for what should be happening. What should be happening? And when you get involved, I sort of sense that you're not going over to, you can get involved not to take over the case, but to offer whatever help, whatever suggestions, because these are dogma cases. And you sort of, it's funny, where you started is where you ended. Because why are these cases so difficult to defend? Because they're dogma type cases. Mm-hmm. There's an injured or dead child, which is nothing worse that we can possibly think of in our worst imaginations, as you go to home and you put your child to bed. And that has a tendency to bring out all the worst zealous characteristics of the system, including prosecutors who will use tactics, take liberties, argue things because they think they're right. And that's the worst.
The ends justify the means, right?
Yeah. And that's the worst.
And I'll tell you, Steve, I agree with everything you just said. That is the danger. That is the hurdle. That is the difficulty we have as defense lawyers. And you're right. When I get contacted by lawyers in other states, other jurisdictions, I get hired to consult and not take the case over more than I take the case over. I don't need to take over a case in Arizona. You want to hire me to come down there and work with you on strategy, motion practice,
experts.
Preparation, experts,
yeah.
You know, focus group or a mock trial? I'm happy to do that. Again, the key is you can win these cases. But to do that, you have to be prepared, and not just spinning your wheels and going through the motions. You have to be prepared with a purpose and with a plan. And I think that if you are in a situation where you feel like your lawyer isn't preparing with a purpose and a plan, then call us.
Well, look, how do people get a hold of you, Mark? What's the...
Satawa Law is my main office is in Southfield, Michigan. It's online. All you have to do is Google Satawa Law. Satawalaw.com is, you know, look, I'm not hard to find.
Yeah, he's not hard to find. Yeah. And obviously, you've mentioned it. We do some consulting. We have another company called Criminal Defense Consultants. So that's easy too. CriminalDefenseConsultants.com.
In our defense, we did name it CDC prior to COVID. We didn't know what we were getting into. Right.
Right. We are not the Center for Disease Control. In fact, they may have stolen our name. At any rate, this is Lawyer Talk off the record on the air. It was a little bit longer than normal, but great content. Thanks for coming down, Mark. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
By the way, we're sponsored by Circle 270 Media. Phenomenal. If you've got a podcast that you want, if you're in the Central Ohio area, even nationally, great podcast consultant, check out Circle 270 Media. Brett over there will take care of you.